Mr. Rorschacher, I can explain this. Fuck.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is episode 2 of season 2, and it's called All Better Now.
It first aired in the U.S. on January 13th, 2002, and worldwide on January 28th, 2002.
It was directed by John Grayson, who did 4 episodes of Queer as Folk. The last time that we saw his work was in Move It or Lose It, which was episode 12 of season 1. I think we like that one.
I like to move it, lose it.
So. You said that last time too, I think.
I know, and I think it was a joke that bared repeating.
Outstanding.
All Better Now was written by showrunners Ron Cowan and Daniel Lipman. We'll be saying that a lot this season because they were the principal writers of every show this season.
Already after episode 1, I sensed a difference with consistent writing, so we'll see how that plays out here. The Showtime synopsis. Justin is unable to process Chris Hobbs's attack. Kind of awkward use of the apostrophe there. Or to accept physical contact despite Brian's best efforts. Ted is fired for surfing porn at work. That was a great story. Michael and Emmett take jobs as naked waiters. I know what you're going to say about that one. This time it's Melanie who proposes to Lindsay.
IMDb synopsis. Still traumatized from his bashing, Justin is unable to get close to Brian. Ted's boss fires him for surfing porn at work. Duh.
Mr. Wirtschafter.
With a name like that, too. And Michael and Emmett work as nude waiters.
This episode started out with some interesting cinematography. We see upside down shots of Justin going into Brian's loft. We see the water again, which Justin crossing the water is something that comes back a number of times in the show. So it was a nice little call out to both episode 1 and several other episodes in season 1 where Justin has to make these journeys. And it's the well-described baptism into the gay community that Justin is going through. So we get this upside down shot and it flips over, but we get the sense that not everything's right as it's happening.
If you feel that it's off.
So we see Justin get up to the door of the loft and it slides open and the ever creepy Chris Hobbs is inside, pulls him in.
Brian!
And at that moment, we realize that this was not real, that it was a dream scene.
That yell as Justin is pulled through the door, it made him sound like he was like half-heartedly worried. It was sort of like a,
Yeah, it did have, it was a little kind of cartoonish sounding.
But it wasn't that like a Wilhelm scream kind of
right.
thing. It wasn't that. It was just like a, it was so muted or like, oh, I'm terrified right now. Like,
yeah,
it was like they had Randy Harrison in the ADR booth and he's just like, I want to go home. This is all you're going to get.
Yeah. One take. That's it. There's a quick jump from there to Babylon. Some sort of synchronized dance number is happening on the dance floor. What the fuck was that?
They were doing some sort of line dance and I don't understand why.
It was a line dance? Like that, country western, they were, like used
they
to
were,
be.
Well, they looked like Chicago they were in a line Charlie's. And they were in a line and they were doing the same moves, so you know.
Did you recognize the dance?
No.
You direct musical theater after
no,
all.
other than the Macarena and the Cupid Shuffle, I don't know any other type of line dance.
The Hustle?
Okay, yeah, there's the Hustle.
We saw Debbie and Vic do it a few episodes ago. Yeah, so I didn't quite understand that. I did like that this episode started out the way that a lot of episodes in season 1 did, which is a gathering at Babylon and lots of chit-chatting. I like those kind of like silly little meaningless chit-chats at the beginning of episodes. I don't know why. I just like this banal banter between the gang.
At first, it seems like it's meaningless chat, but it's actually an entryway into what they're going to discuss during the episode. In this instance, we have Emmett saying that he wishes he had a better ass. And then Ted giving the advice that it's not fiscally responsible to buy an ass.
Yeah. Well, Emmett does eventually buy an ass. Well, no, he doesn't. We're foreshadowing too much.
But that whole point is to show, like, Ted is continually doing his job as the accountant.
Oh, yeah.
And the numbers guy. But
had to have an establishing shot of Ted as, air quotes, accountant.
You almost want to see, like, a title card of each of the characters. Ted. And he does, like, that 90s sitcom turn with his head and just says, accountant.
We saw a few of those in this episode. We'll call those out as we get to them. So the main storyline in this episode was really Justin's ongoing PTSD. So let's talk about that for a little bit. There was this opening scene where Jennifer is at Debbie and Vic's house talking about Justin.
He had nightmares again last night. I went in to comfort him, but the doctor says it's normal. If you can call that normal. That kind of behavior. If someone's been attacked. But to see him in that kind of pain, you know, I want to help him. Only there doesn't seem to be any way. I can't.
What do you think Jennifer was doing at Debbie and Vic's house? So why did she go to them? Are they her only friends?
These are probably the only friends that she can talk freely about Justin. Plus, remember, Debbie's gone through this. She's raised a son who is gay.
But not one that's been bashed and in a coma and had a skull cracked open.
Do you think that might be experience that Vic has?
Ah, interesting. I didn't think of that. Vic did have a little more lines in this episode. He had that really nice one where he says that black bottoms are his specialty.
I used to be a pastry chef.
Black bottoms were my specialty.
I didn't say a word.
Go, Vic. You
almost think that he said that specifically to try and set up Debbie to take the punchline. And she's like, I'm being troop. Good. I didn't say anything. But I'm like, I'm sure she had like four or five in the back end just like throw out there.
Yeah. Vic is getting healthier and healthier every episode.
Yeah,
he looked tan this episode, and he's wearing normal clothing, not like those rundown pajamas and sweats that he was wearing throughout season one. So I like that they're making somebody that's HIV positive healthy looking.
That it's a sustainable chronic disease rather than the death sentence that it tends to be portrayed.
It's interesting that the show evolved so much from season one, where they just had Vic, like he had just run two marathons and did a triathlon the same day, and then tossed off somebody in the mall parking lot on the way back, or bathroom,
yes.
He was arrested for that in season one. Now he just seems to be a really more fully formed character, and I like how Vic is progressing there. There was something in this scene that I kind of bumped on, which was Jennifer basically told Debbie to back off.
You know, Jen, they say that a boy's best friend, especially a gay boy, is his mother, but that's not always the case. Maybe what he needs right now is somebody else. Somebody who could get close to him. More important, someone that he would like to be close to.
Debbie, I'm sorry, but not after what happened.
Well, it was just a suggestion.
Besides, I can look after him myself.
Of course you can.
And I thought it was strange that Debbie just kind of took that and did back off. Normally, Debbie would be in your face and calling bullshit. So I thought that was interesting that Debbie decided to respect Jennifer's role as Justin's mother, even though Sherry Miller, playing Jennifer Taylor, had been mostly absent from Justin's life for many episodes.
It's an interesting point to bring up. Like, why is Debbie sort of toning herself down when we see her have no problem being boisterous? I mean, like the moment when she's in the courtroom during Chris Hobbs's, during his sentencing, and she's like very loudly talking about what a shithead he is.
And then outside, she just about bum rushed him and knocked him down.
But here, maybe it's like an inner life thing that Sharon Gless came up with to justify it. And this is me seeing how maybe a director approached it, is that because Jennifer has seen Debbie as a sort of confidant and maybe even a mentor in a way, let's go with that, that she also has to allow Jennifer to rebuild that relationship with Justin. Because as you said, yeah, she's been absent throughout a good chunk of it as he's doing this discovery of himself.
There was a nice cut where Justin showed up at Brian's loft again. So that was a nice flashback to the opener. It kept us guessing, like, which is real, which is fake. But then Brian is at the door.
Yeah, I almost wanted them to do one more nightmare than to, because like, it's the same thing with comedy where the punchline always lands in terms in numbers of three.
Mm.
So I was expecting there to be one more nightmare to really show us that this is the effect of his of Justin's PTSD, and then to give us a third one where that's the real one. But maybe for time, they just couldn't do it.
Yeah. I hated how awful Brian was to Justin there. He was trying to honor Jennifer's wishes from episode one, which was to leave him alone and get away from him. It just seemed unlike Brian to play by the rules, though. So I couldn't figure out why he was respecting Jennifer's wishes there when he was just so clearly hurting Justin's feelings. Surely he's got to realize that it's only going to make Justin's PTSD worse if he is awful to him. I just couldn't figure out the meaning behind that scene and why Brian felt that he had to be such an ass to him.
It reminded me of Michael's birthday party in the first season where Brian took the advice of Debbie to the extreme, and in order to remove himself from that relationship, he took it really far. I don't know, to like make it stick. So
yeah,
perhaps that's his method of making things stick. But
I didn't
we know Justin, he's always sort of treated Justin kind of shitty. Like,
well, not entirely, because remember in the last season we talked about this evolution of the relationship between them where Justin had become more of a full-fledged member of the gang, and Brian had stopped opening every scene with Justin with a mock on Justin. Now, that happened like around episode 15-ish or so out of 22. It was like Brian finally realized that he liked having this kid in his life and he didn't need to mock him every time. He didn't need to say, oh, look, it's the cast from Zoom, or what are you doing here? Why are you working here? You know, stuff like that. So it just seemed like a very strange story item that he had to be that mean to him.
Again, I think that's just Brian's way of playing to an extreme. If the only way that he can try to cut off the ties between them is to take his mocking or cutting nature towards Justin and take it to where it's cruel in a way, that could be it. But I also think Justin is savvy enough to know that something is up. Even if I think he's also kind of,
I don't know,
always in love with him, no matter how he gets treated by Brian.
But the next scene, we see just how unbalanced Justin is, where he's tearing up his room. There's one funny thing about this scene that I just had to call out, which is there's a pencil drawing of Daphne on the wall. Did you see that?
I didn't, because I was watching the self-destruction of this poor kid, but...
Yeah, I was looking to see what he had drawn that he was tearing down. So poor Daphne's drawing gets ripped off the wall. The mysterious younger Taylor sibling, Molly, comes running in.
Justin, my God, what are you doing? Stop! Stop!
Why is Justin freaking out?
Molly, go back to your room. Go on!
And then she's just gone. I don't think we ever see her again.
That must have been like a child actor law. she was only allowed on that set for a full 10 minutes to get that shot.
The one thing about this scene that was really scary that I didn't like was that Justin literally throws Jennifer to the floor twice.
This is what made Justin's breakdown incredibly hard to watch.
She should have called the police on him.
I don't think calling the police on a kid who's suffering from PTSD is a really good idea.
You can't attack your mother, especially not Jennifer Taylor.
Well, sure. But his mental state in that moment, that's got to be hard. Like, that's what was just so difficult about it. And probably why Jennifer went to that probably desperate measure in taking Debbie's advice of bringing Brian back into his life. But yeah, that whole sequence where he's just tearing everything down. I mean, he's filled with such rage.
Yeah, I can see that it was needed to tell this story, but it seemed like a line that he crossed that you kind of don't get to do.
I'm in agreement. Like, I can't imagine.
He threw her to the ground twice. One time she like hit the small of her back on the bed frame. And
I literally thought she had injured herself in some way. Like, that was terrifying. So
it's like, Jennifer, are you okay?
Right. Like, I almost... I know Craig's not in their life, but I could almost expect him to like come in there and just.
Maybe that scene would have worked better if it was with Craig.
If it was Craig, oh
yeah,
God.
Because maybe Justin and Craig having a knockdown drag out is a little more believable, but not Justin and Jennifer. That it just seemed weird.
I think that shows how deteriorating his mental state really is.
Yeah. To me, though, it was saying like this kid needs to be not at home. He needs to be in professional care. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in the future. We find out that Brian's getting kind of pulled into this as well. And we start to see that Brian has his own version of PTSD going on. He's completely off his game. In episode one, we saw him tricking with everybody in sight. This episode, we see him with what I called the Citizen Kane twunk.
He is billed in IMDb as no underwear.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because he stood up, we see his ass, and his jeans just come right over. Very nice butt. He's cute.
I was a fan.
I'm a fan, too. Let's look him up.
Yes.
Did you ever see Citizen Kane?
Yeah. All my life, all I've ever heard is how it's the greatest fucking movie ever made. So, I finally rent it. The guy who plays the lead is fat. The story about some sled sucks. And it's in black and white.
Maybe you were expecting too much.
Like with you. All I've ever heard is how Brian Kinney's the greatest fuck ever. If you ask me, you're both highly overrated.
Everybody's a critic.
There was a nice piece of writing there to give us some info that all's not well with Brian. The Brian magic and the Brian aura was a little bit dim. He wasn't on top of his game. He wasn't fucking the way that he normally can fuck. He didn't completely destroy this twink and twunk, sorry.
Twunk. And Mr. No Underwear uses the analogy of talking about the film Citizen Kane.
That was funny.
My major disagreement is that Citizen Kane is a brilliant film from a technical standpoint. The way Orson Welles filmed that and told that story is nothing short of genius. So No Underwear can go fuck himself. But I do like the point he was making, and he sort of cuts Brian down to size.
Yeah, the funny thing about Citizen Kane, though, is that these days nobody takes the time to appreciate it. If it's not 140 or 280 characters, and if it's not force-fed to them with explosions and superheroes, nobody like can appreciate real cinematic storytelling.
See,
That's why I thought the writing was clever in this
absolutely
scene.
And that's why I was able to relate to what No Underwear was saying, even though I disagree with his assessment of Citizen Kane. He has a point in using Citizen Kane, which is well known as one of the greatest films ever made, if not the greatest film ever made. And I'm the kind of cinephile, like I was the one who was 14 and seeing Gosford Park in theaters. Which, by the way, if you have never watched Gosford Park, it's from the creator of Downton Abbey.
I watched it after you told me to, and I think I remember like sending you little video clips of it as I was watching it.
It's absolutely wonderful. A murder mystery whodunit directed by Robert Altman. Highly recommend. Nevertheless. So the Citizen Kane twunk, otherwise known as No Underwear, is getting ready to leave when Brian opens the door and Jennifer's there.
Yeah. This little sight gag happens often where Brian opens the door butt ass naked after just banging some twink. So he's probably still like a little chubbed up, and there's Justin's mother.
He has, as one of my other favorite podcasts says, he has a post-cum puffy dick.
I did like how Sherry Miller dropped in this cute little look where she makes eye contact with Brian, then kind of does this quick eye glance down, then eye glance up, and her eyes opened really wide. It was just like half a second.
Yeah, he was a little puffy.
And I loved how Sherry Miller threw that in. It was just so perfect in that moment.
Do you think she wonders, like, that has been inside my son so many times?
She probably didn't go to that level, but...
I mean, we did see her, see the fantasy of Justin being bent over a piano getting fucked by Brian.
That's true.
So... That was another
awkward scene. I loved how Jennifer somehow managed to just get into the building and get up to that door. Once again, these people get all the way past the front door, all the way up the elevator, and then they're knocking on the door, or they're just there when the door opens. All these people getting in?
I think
no wonder Brian got robbed.
Yeah, I think his buzzer's broken. Because at least in the nightmare that Justin set up.
Oh yeah, because like, Justin got
it. It was just buzzing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's just broken, and no one has thought to call the condo association or something. Like, hey, can we get this looked at?
You'd think that Brian's the only one that lives in that building,
right?
Come to think of it, we never see anybody else in that building, do we? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Jennifer had a really weird line, a really weird exchange with Brian where she says, I want you to take my son. And then she gives this wonderful touch him speech is what I called it. Let's listen to it real quick.
What would you like me to do?
Touch him. Help him be touched.
You want me to fuck him?
That line, fuck him, you want me to fuck him? It's like, Brian, that's his mother. It's like, what are you?
You think he cares?
Well, he should.
He should, doesn't mean he will. Like we said in the beginning of this episode, Brian is one not to follow the rules.
Well, apparently this was enough because all of a sudden, Justin and Brian are in the Jeep cruising around town.
It's almost like Brian is Justin's drug.
That's interesting.
You know what I mean? Because it calms him down. He comes down from it in a way because he finally got the thing he needed.
Well, Brian's defending Justin for meaning well, which I thought was interesting. This was another clue that Brian just kind of went away at Jennifer's ask. It was interesting.
As we're dissecting this, I'm curious to know what you think. We've seen what Brian's relationship was with his father and with his mother. The limited time that we've seen his mother, and she was very cold and not, it didn't seem like she was a loving type of person.
Mm-hmm.
And because of how Brian watched the destruction of Justin's home life, do you think it's because he can still respect Jennifer in a way that maybe he never saw his own mother?
If so, that's a pretty deep theme that I'd be surprised if season one writers were capable of doing. I'm starting to respect Cohen and Lippman a lot more in season two. So I think it's possible that they're planting those types of motifs under the surface. I hope so. It makes the episodes a lot better.
And I think it starts to peel away at the layers that are Brian, because we saw how he went along with the plan when Debbie told him that he needed to step away from Michael. And right. he's always seen Debbie as a mother figure as well.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think he is finally finding an attachment to those mother figure, to that maternal figure that he probably never had.
Mm-hmm.
So that's starting to unlock for me why he acts the way he does around Jennifer. Because also Jennifer and Debbie are the ones who have no problem calling him on his bullshit.
Yeah, that's true. Justin was all giddy that he's back with Brian, and he had kind of these little nya-nya-nya-nya-nya moments in the Jeep. It was interesting how Cohen and Lippman were giving us that sense that Brian really does deeply care about Justin without hitting us over the head with it. That tenderness and that familiarity and intimacy that they had while they were going for their Jeep ride really made sense. These second season stories are just much better thought out than the first season. The first season had so many different writers and so many different directors. It was almost like they had a fishbowl of ideas, and for each episode, the writer just walked up and grabbed an idea and wrote about it. There wasn't a very long arc, and we didn't get much depth in the characters. Season two, episode two, I'm already seeing just this big change in the way that the show is structured.
And I think because we have such a defining event with this bashing, it's as if Justin and Brian had to have a reintroduction, because so much of it harkens back to the first couple of episodes from season one.
It's funny you say that, because I was thinking that season two could start the entire series on its own.
If we just had
the last 5 minutes of season one and then the rest of season two, that could have been the starting point for it.
Exactly.
It could have been a really great show.
So it's a way that we had this defining event, and now we have to almost be reintroduced to these characters with this new information.
It's like a reboot.
Exactly. When is Netflix going to reboot this, you know?
No, hopefully never. You know, a lot of people that we're talking to on like Facebook and Twitter, a lot of these people are really dying to have a reboot of this show with the same characters and the same actors. And I think that's a terrible idea. I can't see these characters being 20 years older the same way. It would be just a very different show. It would have to be something else. It almost like a spinoff versus a continuation. Because I don't really want to see what happened to these characters next. I like the way that the show ended. They gave us all, the writers and directors gave us everything about these characters, and that's it.
I think the only way this could be rebooted is if Randy Harrison becomes the Brian of the series.
See, and he picks up his own. This is way too predictable. Nobody wants to see that.
Because I mean, based on some of the comments I think we've seen on Facebook, I think some of our fans would be interested in seeing where that reboot would take.
But they want to see like Justin kind of like right after the series ended. But the actor, Randy Harrison, is 18 years older now. He's well beyond the age that Brian was.
And so still looks good.
I just don't see as that a continuation could actually work. And I had asked that question on Facebook, whether people would want to see a continuation or whether they would want to see a reboot. And a lot of people wanted to see the continuation. They wanted to see what's next for these characters. But I like to think of these characters as having gone as far as they can go. And that's all we get.
We'll be right back. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
I got a problem with Brian here.
Whoa.
This first night where Brian's going to seduce Justin and like fuck him back into reality. Oh, I thought Brian like totally misplayed this.
Oh my God. It's like his dick has magical powers.
Yeah. This made no sense. And I didn't like that Brian suddenly became so naive. One upside is there's a quick underwear check for Justin. I think we stopped talking about those at some point.
Well, at some point, everyone stopped wearing underwear. Yeah. There's literally a character who is called No Underwear. So yeah, of course we had to stop underwear check.
So Brian's in bed naked. And I did notice that Grayson shot all of the Brian bedroom scenes in blue. Love that. I just love the blue light that was surrounding it. It really set everything apart. It set the sex apart from the emotions. And then it tied them all together when the characters were transitioning between the blue and the white light. So Brian's in bed naked. Justin shows up wearing like a long sleeve shirt and long boxer shorts. And then Brian goes like straight to fucking him.
There was no foreplay.
Yeah. And
he literally is like, you should take your clothes off. And then he just goes right to a condom. I'm like,
yeah,
I think he kissed him maybe once.
Kinda. It was like a quick seduction. It was a little bit more of a seduction than what Brian typically gives in the alley or the back room of Babylon. But still, I mean, this is Justin, the boy suffering from PTSD. Brian just reaches over, grabs a condom.
And he's like, all right,
he's apparently hard already.
Ready to put it in. I think he's hard half the time.
Yeah, rolls anyway. Right on top of Justin and starts shoving it in.
Jeez.
And Justin still has PTSD. And now Brian has created a situation where Justin feels even like more inferior because he can't give Brian what he thinks Brian wants. So I just thought that Brian was a big goof here.
He wasn't, I mean, no surprise, he wasn't thinking, but
yeah. Normally he does. Normally he comes across as like a well thought out, calculating character. But here he's just like, flip over, Justin.
We have finally found uncharted territory for Brian, and he's not succeeding.
His little lack of success here leads us to an even more kind of weird scene with Dr. Alex Wilder,
you would think was like one part of the gang. With all of a sudden, we have this new person we've never seen before, but he has such a casual, like intimate conversation with Brian about this kind of thing. And I'm like, wait a minute, who are you again? Yeah,
in Woody's too. So the note that I wrote down about Dr. Alex Wilder, and we never hear his name. That's just in the credits. I put, and I like to say this a lot about characters that are just very cliche and stereotypical. This man was very much therapist in air quotes. He looked like a therapist and he is, you know, for the most part, acting like one, not entirely. And I loved how he kept taking shots at Brian while trying to give Brian advice. Like he was always throwing in these tiny little barbs.
You know, for someone who has enough disorders to merit your own classification in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, you are one of the most well-adjusted and high-functioning bastards I know.
The advice he was giving was accurate, but what he told Brian to do should not have been done by amateurs. This should have been done like in a clinical setting. He's telling Brian that Justin has to relive all this. So Brian's taking it upon himself to actually recreate the whole thing. But Brian's not a trained therapist. He's not a trained psychologist or knows nothing of PTSD. So I thought that was bad advice from Dr. Wilder.
And are we assuming that just because on the credits that he is in fact a doctor?
Well, he does identify to Brian as, I think he said, a shrink. So, yeah, he said, well, you're talking to one now. So we're given enough information to know that this guy's a mental health professional. Whether he's a psychiatrist, psychologist, or psychology student, we're not sure. Maybe that's it. Maybe he's like so junior in his career that he doesn't think twice about sending Brian out to do the job of a therapist.
He was just looking for dick, let's be honest.
Which is the next problem that I bumped on here, which is Dr. Wilder violated every tenet of therapy by telling Brian that he expects sexual favors in trade for the counseling that he just gave him.
So how much do I owe you?
I'll take it out in trade. Next time I see you in the baths.
Oh, really?
When they go to the baths.
I would have rather he been chatting with what's his name, Marty?
Yeah. Or how about Dr. David Cameron?
Oh,
Brandy's
my God.
A chiropractor, but he's got some training, there, right?
There's at least a doctor in his title.
So this scene you really needed to suspend disbelief with and just kind of go with it. It had too much comedy kind of woven into the seriousness of it. I think it might have played off better if this therapist wasn't so blatant about hooking up with Brian, blatant about trying to get Brian to do something of a clinical nature without any training. So set up the recreation of the prom scene, though, which definitely gets some good lines here.
When you put all of that into context, that this, we assume, mental health professional has given this advice to Brian to reenact, that's putting a lot of, it's a very delicate thing to put in Brian's hands that if not done not done well, that's going to wreck Justin. So we're just going to have to assume that it's going to work out.
I think we had to assume that it wouldn't work out, though, in order to make the drama keep working.
But we have this recreation happening. It starts out with the music and Daphne.
Daphne. It was good to see Daphne again.
Daphne is played by Michaela Smith.
Michaela.
Oh, Michaela Smith. Sorry. Yeah, whenever she appears, like, she serves her purpose.
she just vanishes.
And then usually vanishes, but usually gets one or two really great, like, one-liners out. It just makes me really appreciate her.
She was in 29 episodes of the show, off and on, kind of throughout every season. So that's about a third of the episode. And according to IMDb, she never acted again after this show.
She went out on a high note.
She should have.
Daphne is the pinnacle of her career, and she is okay with that. Good for her.
Yeah, I thought she was pretty good in a lot of places. I think some of her lines were really lightweight, but she did her best. She gave it a good chance there. Grayson's direction in this recreation scene in Brian's loft was pretty interesting. It was flashbacks to the actual prom scene intermixed with the recreation in Brian's loft. There was one line there where Justin was really surprised that Brian kissed him at the prom in front of everybody.
When you guys kissed, so hot.
Kiss me? In front of everybody? Yeah.
I really like that.
Well, how much, I think it was stated, or if not, please correct me, that there was a certain point to where he only remembers.
He remembered going to the prom and that's it. He didn't remember anything happening at the prom.
So it's almost like him discovering, probably like him being kissed that first time at the end of the first season when Brian took that step. That's probably that recreation. That's why it surprised him. It's like he's him getting kissed again in front of everyone. It's a show that there is no fear. And I know, and I think it's actually it's a great moment. It shows that Brian has really warmed himself to this relationship. I'm going to call it a relationship because that's what it is.
Yeah, I think we started to call it that in season one, episode 14 or so. I think we started to really regarded as a legitimate relationship. Mm-hmm. They're down in the parking lot and Brian had a line that let's listen to it real quick.
And then you turned around and smiled. Then I knew why Debbie calls you sunshine.
I'm not sure why I tripped up on that line. It just sounded very un-Brian. Even if he's trying to help Justin remember the attack, sunshine thing.
It's a little too saccharine for Brian as a character to recall something as sweet as that. I never really saw Brian as the kind of person who would be that kind of warm to it.
Or would have even have noticed. But it's like, you have a big bubble butt. That I noticed. Do I notice you being sunshine because you smile? No.
But maybe that's his method in this sort of psychological trickery that he's doing.
It was, that line was enough to make me start to see that. I don't know if this scene or if this whole recreation was more about Justin or more about Brian. I'm not sure which one it was benefiting most at that moment, because we're ostensibly seeing this to try to help Justin. But once we're down in the parking lot, we start to see that Brian is way fucked up over what had happened. He witnessed all this.
But we also know Brian to be fucked up already, because in the beginning of this season, we see that he's wearing the bloody scarf around him.
Yeah. And then Justin begins to almost console Brian, which was a big turnaround, because Brian was doing this. Brian and Daphne were doing this all for Justin, but then the roles reversed and Justin is trying to give comfort to Brian. The scene was handheld, which gave it this really, really wonderful disorienting feel, which is really what the characters were experiencing at the time. So I liked Grayson's choice there of handheld. There's a number of other episodes where I really questioned why the scene was handheld, but this one made sense. There's a nice interchange between Justin and Brian here where Justin says,
I wish I could remember. I wish I could forget.
This was the most obvious thing from Brian so far, that he's struggling with this. When he says that he can't forget it, we see that his symptoms in episode 1 of season 2, but here he came right out and said it. Up until now, he's never really said just how screwed up this made him. I love that exchange.
And I think that supports what you're saying, that this reenactment is helping Brian just as much as it's helping Justin. He now is starting to crack what's going on in his head, and that's going to help him heal, and it's going to help Justin heal, and it's going to help them heal each other.
I like that it was Brian's son, Gus, swinging the little baby baseball bat that triggered Justin's memory.
They should have thought about that.
What do you mean?
You would have thought that Mel and Lindsay would have seen like a bat and you know what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but I liked how Cohen and Lippman tied a bow on this one by having Brian's son be the catalyst to Justin remembering. So yeah, okay, maybe they shouldn't have given away a baseball bat, but I did like the way that it was tied together. And I loved how Brian immediately saw what was going on. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw that Justin started to struggle. He just put his arms around him, held him close.
It reminded me of that HBO movie, Temple Grandin, where she had created the machines to be basically a giant hugging machine. Based on her studies with cows, in order to like calm them down, the pressure helps.
Oh, it's like one of those little coats for dogs in a thunderstorm that you put on the dog.
Yeah, like that. It's the pressure. It's the pressure that helps bring Justin down. That's what it's just an interesting little detail that really helps show that Brian has taken this role of caretaker very seriously,
mm-hmm.
and is showing me that Brian may not be a total asshole the way I thought he was in season one.
I hate it when you say that.
The truth hurts, Patrick.
The character is deeper than that, and I think it's just a quick dismissal to say Brian's an asshole. He's just a whore.
I did the same thing with Dr. David Cameron.
I went deep on Dr. David, and I tried to...
I want to go deep on Dr. David Cameron, too.
We already did. But I tried to find deeper motivation than the kind of the force-fed thing. And I think Brian Kinney is one of the most misunderstood characters. And granted, it's a minority of people that think that he's anything more than an asshole. But I think anybody that studies the writing and the total arc can see a very different character. And I like trying to talk about that, even though you roll your eyes and stomp at me and then drink wine in my face.
But you can't argue that his ego and his assholishness behavior is kind of part of his charm as a character.
And it's also what led kind of indirectly or maybe directly to Justin getting bashed over the head. You know, he was making a scene in that prom. He showed up to show all those straights what it's really all about. that's what we're seeing in this episode, where he's paying the price for some of his decisions. And this was really the first time that his ostentatious behavior had such a direct and devastating effect on somebody that we know that he cares about. Even if he doesn't come right out and say it all the time or act like it all the time, we know that. And that's the deeper things that I look for in the Brian character. I've never really thought of him as just being the overall scoundrel. I think he has scoundrel moments, but for the most part, I think there's a lot more to him than that. I did think it was weird, though, that he thought he could just fuck the PTSD right out of Justin.
But that makes the final moments of this episode really land when they go back to the loft.
There was an underwear check here.
Oh, yes.
Justin had upgraded from his big droopy boxers to some nice long trunks. They were meh.
But, were they long? I thought they were a good thigh cut.
Yeah, that's long.
That's long? Oh.
Yeah, trunks are sort of like briefs without the arch in them. Boxer briefs would be the mid-thigh cut. Think Under Armour.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So the blue light scene is back.
It's the blue light special, yes.
Justin and Brian are in bed. When the blue lights are on, they're amazingly intimate with each other. We see relationship in the blue light, not that cat and mouse game that we saw in season one where Justin and Brian are kind of at different points, the mouse and the cat, and they switch back and forth several times in season one. The one thing that I did bump out here, though, was why is Brian wearing that bloody scarf to bed with Justin? It was great symbolism, but for Justin to see it and pull it off, it surprised the hell out of me that Brian would do that.
I mean, maybe it is just tied to the symbolism of that he's able to remove that weight. He doesn't like that Brian doesn't have to carry that weight anymore.
Yeah, Justin kind of released him from it, but
right.
That's why I like the symbolism. But again, it's like, Brian, what the hell are you thinking?
Well, when it's being used for symbolism and you start to deconstruct that, you're starting to remove the purpose of that symbol. Does that make sense? In that, logically, it doesn't make sense for him to be wearing that or for Justin to do that, but to show to the audience what it means.
I guess we needed a preamble to that. Where like Justin finds the scarf someplace else and they like have a couple lines about it versus like, oh, look, Brian's wearing a bloody scarf. Let me take it off of him. It just seemed too stitched together.
So you were looking for more acknowledgement that Brian is wearing that scarf and you wanted Justin to comment on it?
I wanted more acknowledgement that Justin recognized what it was. This is the first time I think that Justin became aware of that scarf.
I mean, that's a possibility. It's a possibility because remember, he doesn't, well, Justin doesn't remember.
he did remember, but I don't think he would have a memory of this particular scarf because.
Exactly. So he's looking at this bloody scarf
that Brian's mysteriously wearing in bed.
This is me deriving meaning behind it, and that it's possible that Justin acknowledged or is able to understand non-verbally that scarf was tied to the incident.
Okay, I'm with you there.
And so without saying anything, he's able to acknowledge it and pass that on to Brian and remove it so that through action rather than words, he's relieving Brian of that burden.
Yeah, I can get there with that. So Justin remembers, and of course he wants to be topped right away.
So, I want you inside me.
That was quick. There was a nice callback to things that we had seen in the past. Let's listen to this scene real quick.
I want you inside me.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Just take it easy.
Like the first time?
This sex scene had no music in it until the scene was ending. Not even like an emotional oboe.
I was very into it. It was just showing the care.
Yeah.
And what was lacking from the first time Brian tries to top Justin in this episode, to see him taking his time and being comforting. This is where I would say it was not fucking, it was lovemaking. Which I hate that phrase, but that's what it was. This is something
that needed the emotional oboe.
Which only starts to fade in as the camera pans away.
Yeah, that song. Scarf. So half the sex scene had no music. There's just ambient sound. We hear a little bit of street noise. We hear them, and that was great. And then a song by Sigur Rós comes in, and it's called. This is in Icelandic, so I only pronounce Icelandic slightly worse than my French from several episodes. So this was Svenji Englar by Sigur Rós that was playing under that scene. That song title is Icelandic for sleepwalkers, and the song is sung in Icelandic, but the first few lines loosely translate to, I'm back inside of you, it's so nice to be here. And whoa. I thought that music supervision there was awesome, and I just wanted to give a shout out to Michael Perlmutter and Scott McFadden, who did the music supervision on this. I did check the streaming version, and there's a very terrible approximation of the song, but funny enough, that Sigur Rós song actually has a little bit of Icelandic gibberish in it. Well, they're not real words. They're kind of going between Icelandic and a little bit of English, but I looked at a few translations of it, and there were notes in all of them that said that this is vocalizations. It's not actually meant to be words. The streaming version has English words in it, so somebody actually took the time to write lyrics for this and drop them in. This is one particular scene where I just need to insist that all of our listeners buy the DVD episode and watch this scene, because it's one of the best directed and best scored scenes that we've had out of, we're up to 24 episodes now that we've done. This is worth the $15 alone to buy season 2 on DVD. So, all better now indeed. Justin has been fucked back out of PTSD. I just thought that this story seemed to wrap up pretty quickly. You know, it's like the Ted's coma conundrum, where Ted goes into a coma for less than 42 minutes of screen time, and then everything's like back to normal.
I think they're over the larger part of the struggle. Do I think he's completely cured because of Brian's magical dick? I don't think so. But I think they had a breakthrough.
Yeah, and maybe that's why I hit on this, is I think I would have liked to have seen a little more struggle than 50 minutes of television. I would have liked to have seen this getting over that first hump last a little bit longer. But we do know that there's more to come in future episodes. We'll be right back.
Have more to say about the episode? Like us on Facebook and join in on the discussion.
Michael apparently has been on a tear partying.
I
like that storyline.
He's just like, I'm getting blowjobs and I'm partying all night.
He's
and
doing,
I'm
doing drugs.
Drugs. It's like, you want a bump? And he sticks the thing in his nose. I'm like, calm down, Michael.
You go, girl. Debbie had this wonderful line at the diner where she says,
get over David, get a job, and get on with your life.
It made me start to wonder, how long has Michael been back? How long has he been on this tear?
Yeah, and like he really was like a little child again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I kind of like that moment between jobs where you really can just kind of bust it and just go crazy.
It's been so long, I don't know what that even means.
So this leads Michael to the big cue where we see Tracy.
Yay!
For the first time in a while. Did she look a little haggard to you? She don't look as she used to.
I think new manager Andrew is...
Oh, no makeup at work.
I think he is riding them hard.
I hate that Andrew guy. He comes across as just so smarmy and
ugh.
His tone, his attitude, everything was just so annoying. But it worked to make Michael realize that he needed to knock himself down a few notches from being a doctor's wife to being the assistant manager at the Big Q.
Under Andrew.
Yeah. Speaking of Tracy, didn't she take a job at the Big Dollar Mart?
Yes.
I'm glad you brought this up. Big Q.
Convenience for story.
Yeah.
They kind of said screw it to continuity, I think.
Another part of this this B story was Michael took a job as a naked waiter with them.
They didn't know when they were at the job. They just thought they were like going to be working as waiters at a party. When I think Prissy Caterer.
Yeah. That's what he's credited as.
Hands them their uniforms, which is in a tiny paper bag. They realize that they are going to be naked. They just wear a bow tie and a cummerbund.
What was this dinner party that they were serving?
it just straight up pissed me off because I'm viewing it from the 2018 lens. So they're at this party serving wine and food naked and
loved it.
It's just a table of
careful
old white privileged gays.
Privileged.
They're having a dinner party where they were able to hire people to be nude while serving them. Yeah, privileged.
Well, it cost them $1,000 total because they each got paid $500. And there were eight attendants and they had a party planner.
So yeah, again, privileged. Oh, and as they're going around serving, the attendants of said party take it upon themselves to pinch and squeeze and grab and grope any and every part of poor Michael and Emmett.
Well, that served to put Michael into a nice humiliating position to reinforce his zero direction in life, as Debbie had pointed out. So it was a pretty elaborate scene to illustrate that Michael is stooping to the bottom depths to make some money.
Ugh.
I thought it was hilarious. I really laughed at this scene. I could totally see Emmett being a naked waiter every week.
Wait until we get into next week's episode.
Oh, is it next week? Where he's the gay maid?
Yes.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to that. There was the funny scene as they got back to Michael's apartment and they're rubbing something on each other's butts.
Some sort of soothing lotion, like they got sunburn.
Yeah.
Instead, it was like they got creep all over them.
Those were like serious pinch marks. So
yeah.
Those privileged gay men.
But
apparently
we also saw major
like
pubes on. We saw major pubes with Michael.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
Yeah, hey, were you like, Michael, you need to trim?
Yeah. I think Peter Page totally stole this entire scene, and he's just amazing. He's
fearless.
He carries these comedic scenes and their dramatic scenes, like when he had his HIV scare. He's so good. I just loved the way that he is delivering every single scene. My favorite part here was where he was in a hurry to get Michael to rub his butt.
He's like, my turn. And just like
just
drops
rub.
The drawers. Just get in there.
After he had already lined up like another naked gay
gig.
Yeah, I don't know what we'd call that dinner. So Michael goes back, has a double shift at the Big Q. I think that was the catalyst to Gus's birthday party where Michael was just beyond sad. He's like on the swing set, just kind of staring into space.
Woe is fucking me, Michael.
Let's listen to this scene real quick.
Look at me. I'm right back in the same place I was before, and everybody else has moved on.
Who's moved on? Everybody else is literally doing the same thing as they were before Michael left for Portland with Dr. David.
Other than Justin.
Well, Justin became a vegetable for a while, so he's forgiven. But who's moved on?
Right. Ted was, at this time, Ted is still the boring accountant.
Yeah.
And Brian is still getting sucked and fucked by everything that moves on Liberty Avenue. And Debbie is still the loud, boisterous waiter at the diner. Like, yeah, not much has changed. Because, again, he was only gone for, like, a month.
Yeah. I guess Vic's moved on from
death.
Yeah. So I didn't understand that line. I realized that it needed to be there for setting the stage up for what Michael's going to do next, but it didn't totally track. This Michael being lost thing is just way overblown. He hasn't even tried to change his life at all. He's just like, I'm lost. It's like, well, you just came back. You haven't even tried anything. The most that you've tried is to like work at the Big Q and be a naked waiter. That doesn't make you lost. Ted lost his job in this episode, too. This story is set up pretty well. He's leaving Babylon early on because it's a work night. The next morning at the diner, he talks about retiring from Wirtschafter & Company in 31 years.
It terrifies me that he has the next 31 years of his life planned.
Well, that's the Ted that we've come to know and love. So this was a nice reinforcement as we're being set up to what happens next, where we see Ted in his office and the entire office is looking at porn. From each desk, we see them just staring intently at porn.
No security settings. There are no...
Well, this was 2000.
Guidelines.
So it was very difficult.
Programmed onto these computers. It's like, if you have dial-up, you're in.
Yeah. He's looking at MrFister.net. Did we check to see if that's real? We should.
Give me 2 seconds. Continue talking.
He's on a phone call with Emmett. I love the way that there's a little bit of duality here, because Ted's in this mahogany accountant office where he plans on spending the next 31 years of his life. Emmett is in the window of Torso putting underwear onto a mannequin. So I like the way that we see Ted really, you know, live out the rest of his life there, and Emmett kind of living the life. Mr. Wertschafter jumps to the obvious conclusion when he walks in after Ted spills coffee all over himself and hits the boss button on the computer, which is actually the volume button, and he believes that Ted was just whacking off there.
Mr. Wertschafter, I can explain this.
I'm sitting there going, one, why are you watching this at work? I know it seems like that's what everyone is doing, sure. But you also can't be mad that you got caught watching porn at work. You played too close to the fire and you got burnt.
He wasn't mad about that he got caught. He was mad that everybody was doing it, but he was the only one that got fired. And he believed that it was because he was gay. So he confronted Wertschafter over it. And Wertschafter had these really good lines. Let's listen to this scene real quick.
Are you happy being an accountant?
Happy?
Does balancing the books make your heart beat faster?
No, sir, not really.
Then I'm doing you a favor. Next time, find yourself something you have a passion for. Otherwise, you're just jerking yourself off.
That came out of nowhere, because with the exception of his other sir, Dale Wexler, shackling Ted and making him his suck pig, Ted's heart has always been beating faster over balancing the books. He is accountant, in quotes. So why was this suddenly not making his heart beat faster?
He liked the stability of it, but I don't think he ever lived for the fact that, oh, accounting is my passion.
Oh, I think he did, though, because...
Oh, I never thought that at all. I mean, I like my job because it affords me to do things I like. That's it.
You're in the same shape as him, man.
Yes, but I don't watch porn at work. Your way.
So if we think back to when Bad Boy Blake had first shown up at Ted's condo, and Blake says, do you own this? And Ted's like, oh, absolutely. Your home is your most important investment. And then the time where Ted helped Melanie balance her books and spend her nest egg so that Lindsay could take time off, or the time that he arranged for Brian to make the donation to the senator's campaign, or the time that Brian lost his job and Ted advised him on how to make his dollars stretch without a job. It just seemed to me like Ted is accountant. So I don't think there was any buildup to Ted's suddenly being disillusioned with it.
So I think what you describe as him being accountant, that's his function. But as we learned with his reaction to allowing Dale Wexler to take power over him.
Yeah, maybe that was the tipping point.
We started to see what was truly lying underneath.
So, a suck pig,
which, I think that's why having someone straight up confront him, especially it being Wertschafter, giving him like the most potent piece of advice and like really laying it out as clearly as possible to him. Like, have you ever truly felt passionate about this? And allowing him to just be as honest as possible. Like, I know he wanted to go in there with this big speech about how terrible Wertschafter is, but Wertschafter, I think I kind of agree with Wertschafter. He kind of did him a favor.
Yeah, it really teed up what's going to be next for Ted. So this was why we called this part of the B story, where there wasn't a whole lot that was happening with Ted, but it was enough for us to see like there's going to be an A story around Ted soon. Gus's birthday party was going on, and I noticed that Gus is a gigantic one-year-old. He's huge.
Don't give him a complex, Patrick. Jeez.
Oh, that kid is gigantic. The house after the party was completely trashed. It was like...
It was a rager.
Yeah. The only thing missing was like toilet paper in the trees. Melanie finally comes around about the wedding. Lindsay thought that Melanie was kidding when she started describing possible wedding plans. Like, let's put the chuppah over here and let's have this underneath the sycamore trees. And then she saw that it was a little bit real based on a character named Kendall Morgan. This little girl that had one line was credited as Kendall Morgan, and that tipped Melanie off. And something I wrote down was, why couldn't that little girl have been Molly Taylor?
How comfortable is Jennifer with Lindsay and Melanie?
I don't remember.
So I don't know if she would bring her younger daughter to this group of people. I think she probably is making a conscious effort to keep it a little separated.
Yeah. So let's wrap this episode up here and do our scorecards. For timeliness, I gave it a 3. The episode was so specific to this Queer as Fuck universe that it didn't really have any crossover into any current events so much or at the time. What'd you give it for timeliness?
I gave it a 3 also, but the reason why is because mainly that fucking naked waiter scene.
That still happens.
And I
know people that have performed that function.
Well, and I
not here.
And
I didn't
was texting
them.
You as I was watching it. And you could see how angry I was in my text to you. But it reminded me of very much of the discussions we're having today about consent and what is allowed and what we think might be playful could be harmful. And I'm glad that at least there was at least an attempt to make a distinction between how Emmett is experiencing the job as Michael is, because Michael gets pinched and then makes a point of saying, basically, keep your hands off the goods or something.
The tenderloin.
Off the tenderloin, yes.
Keep your hands off the tenderloin.
And they all just thought, oh, he's a saucy one. And I wanted to be like, I want all of you to drop dead of a heart attack right now.
I think it's still timely, though, because it does happen. Like I said, I know people that have served those.
Well, then let me up my score. I'm going to say a 4. And I think it's timely because we're having that discussion now about a party like that happened today, especially because like they were going in there not knowing that they had to be naked. That was a surprise to them when they got there.
Yeah, so that's really more about consent than anything. If they would have consented to that, and the way that Emmett kind of threw himself into the role, at first he was a little nervous about it, but then he was like, yeah, $500? Sure. I'm fine with this. So he knew what he was getting into at that point. The interesting thing, though, is you can go to like any gay bar known as a gay man. You're just pretty much assured that somebody's going to grab you at some point that night or touch you in some way. And I don't mind that and those circumstances.
And that's the thing. Some people might not mind that, but you can't operate under the assumption that everyone is okay with
it. Well, where I was going with it is it seems like at a gay bar, there's a different standard that is set.
Well, and there shouldn't be. I guess is my point.
I don't know how you feel about that. I think, at least for me, being touched playfully at a gay bar is kind of fun. And I like the danger of it. And I like the anonymity of it. I like the conversation starter of it. I can't think of too many times where somebody's done that, where I've thrown a drink in their face. That was only once.
And see, I'm the opposite. Like, people can't assume that they can touch me in a way. Like, it's one thing if I...
Listeners, if you see me, feel free to touch.
Listeners, if you see me, let's have a conversation first and see where it goes. And then maybe if you ask politely.
Second on our scorecard, information accuracy. I'm going to give this a 3 out of 5. LGBT protections are improving. So Ted's storyline about how Ted and Melanie about how he has no protections for being fired because he was gay. At that point, he thought he had been fired because he was gay. And so that's getting better, but it's way, way, way far from being perfect, but not the zero protections that Melanie cited. An interesting thing that I looked up was Pennsylvania, where the show is ostensibly based, Pittsburgh, was the first state in the U.S. to enact a blanket sexual orientation protection for state employees. And this was in 1975. Didn't apply to private sector employees, but Melanie wasn't quite accurate in her statement of saying zero protections. Fun fact, Wisconsin, home of Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, was the first state to protect sexual orientation from discrimination in all employees, state and private. And that was back in 1982. It's hard to believe they elected such a tool for a governor in 2010, a recall election in 2012, and again in 2014. So Wisconsin, stop it.
Get your shit together.
Yeah, vote this guy out. We do like the iron stash, though. So
yes, fully endorsed. I'm basically in agreement with you, Patrick, on the accuracy. Well, I agree. I think we are.
Did you give it a 3?
I gave it a 3 as well.
Okay.
3 out of 5. Yeah. And I think I'm very much on point with what you just went through in terms of the accuracy of, because Ted tries to use this as like some basis of something that could be like some groundbreaking discrimination suit. But I also would be like, when you say, well, I was watching gay porn at work and I got fired because I'd be like, why the fuck were you watching porn at work? He had such a, I don't know, Ted pissed me off with trying to use that as a reason why he got fired.
He's a little heated up there, though. So, you know, when something like that happens, your first thing is, I'm going to sue. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that.
Right.
And, you know, you're still running on full high octane gas at that point. You haven't gotten to the point of running on fumes. So he was really heated up. And he has his piece with Dr. with Mr. Wertschafter, Dr. David. So he gets that out of his system. Mr. Wertschafter sort of sets him straight and says, you're in the wrong job, kid.
Yeah.
Take your Mr. Coffee Maker.
Wertschafter gets real with it. And I was like, oh, who knew?
The third category that we talk about is relatability. And I gave this episode a 4 out of 5. I related to everything in this episode, but I thought that some of the ways it was presented was off, like the barroom therapy session for Brian personally reenacting Justin's attack. I thought that wasn't at all relatable. I just don't see that any well-trained mental health professional would guide somebody into doing something like that. So
try this.
Yeah. Get him to remember. So that was just a story plot device that I thought knocked down the relatability of the episode a little bit.
And that's sort of why I gave it a 3. I think having him use that tactic as a sort of, it felt almost like he was getting a generic prescription when he should have gotten Brand. In addition to that, it was like what sort of made me feel a little more related to it was that fear of being fired for being gay. Like it made me be more cognizant of how I present myself when I'm at my job, whereas it's not a secret. It's definitely not a secret. I mean, like, I feel like I've had...
Welcome to the linen closet.
I've been able to have, like, personal conversations. Like,
hookups?
No. God, no. 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 But more than I've been able to have personal conversations and that, you know, coworkers are privy to my personal life. Like I get asked all the time if I'm dating anyone and stuff like that. So I'm like, oh, they care.
It's like, oh, we know this hot guy down in radiology that you should meet.
Oh, again, no.
I really love this episode. I thought it was super stylish. It was well directed by John Grayson. There's great music, supervision. We finally have good writing coming out of Cohen and Lippman. And I think this is starting to become more proper episodic TV. Last season was just a shit show of themes and different narratives. The characters changed episode to episode. It took them 22 episodes to find their feet.
It was a little like throwing the spaghetti to the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, totally.
And here, by having Cohen and Lippman be the writers for the entire season, and we are definitely, I think, going to see something that is more consistent and cohesive.
I still have a problem with middle-aged men trying to write for young gay men.
For the youngins.
Well, I mean, a good writer should be able to do that. But at least in season one, a lot of the themes that we saw were very kind of cliche, stereotypical old man type of thing. So I'm looking forward to how this season shapes up. So this was episode 2 of season 2. It was entitled All Better Now, directed by John Grayson, written by Ron Cohen and Daniel Lippman.
Next week, we'll cover episode 3, Hypocrisy. Don't do it.
If you listen to us this far, we must have done something right. So please click the subscribe button. It really means a lot to us and it helps us out.
Until then, I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Hey, fine.